Me, this is Danny Testing.
My name is Emily Sokolov, and this is a story my grandmother told me. Well, her family used to live in Albany, and she had six sisters. And one of them married a man who was a Christian Scientist, and she was sort of the strange one in the family. Nobody really took her seriously. And one of my grandmother's sons, two of my grandmother's sisters were using gasoline for something, and my uncle, one of my grandmother's sons, started to drink it. He put some to his lips. They thought he had drunk it. And her sister, the Christian Scientist person, told her that not to take him to the doctor, you know, that God would do it. All she would do is pray for him. And my grandmother told me that she was sort of worried because she wanted to take him to the doctor. And finally, when the Christian Scientist person left, my grandmother told me that she ran with him and she took him to the doctor, but she found out that he hadn't really drunk it. He only put it to his lips.
My name is Karen Dent, and I got this from my father. Well, my great-grandfather was a colonel in the Confederate Army, and he was shot in the ankle and taken prisoner by the Union Army. And he was sent to a prisoner of war camp back east, and I think, I'm not sure, it was New York State. My great-grandmother in Georgia, when she heard about him getting captured, she took a team of horses, a wagon, and she traveled across the southern states and across the Union lines, and brought back my great-grandfather to Georgia. And she saved his life because he was going to get shot. And he had gangrene in his leg, and which later had to be cut off. This one I got from my father, too. In the time of slaves, there was an uncle on my father's side who owned some slaves, and he was around over 400 pounds, and he was over 6 feet tall. And all he had to do was threaten to fall on them, and they would do whatever he wanted instead of using brutality. During the Depression, my father traveled way across from Georgia, from the south, deep south, to the north.
All right.
And he would hitchhike on trains. He would jump on trains and hitchhike on cars. And one day, he was waiting for a train to pull in so he could jump on, and he met this 15-year-old Negro boy, and he never rode a train before in his life, and he asked my father how he could jump on when the train's going. So my father said, "Do whatever I do." So the boy followed him, and on the train, the conductor was watching, and a lot of other people got on, but he saw my father with this Negro boy. And when the train was at its highest speed, around 45 miles per hour, he came after them with around a 3-inch thick, 6 feet long iron bar. And he came after them, and they had to jump. But he first went after the boy, and the train was only going around 25 miles per hour. Then he saved my father for last. And before he got my father off, he kept going through all the trains, and they were on the top. And he came near Sandy and everything, so my father jumped off. And my father told me this one before. I'm trying to think. Well, my father and mother were in show business, and my father was directing, and my mother was co-directing an all-Negro show in Harlem, and they saw this Negro woman whose name was Dent. And she looked very much like the Dent family, you know, bushy eyebrows and high cheekbones. And so they asked her about it, and she said she...
This is the story of her father's arrival in America. When her father was a young boy, he lived with his parents and an older sister in a small village in the Ukraine. And his father managed to get enough money to come to America. And he was going to go there and get a job and find a home and then send for his family with the money he made over there. Well, the rest of the family never heard from him, and the sister and mother decided to go to America themselves. And they only had enough money for themselves, so they went, leaving her father behind with his grandparents. Well, He was very lonely, and he pined for his parents, and the aunt saw this and wrote to his mother telling her this, and she sent money for him to come. Well, by this time it was illegal for the Jewish people to leave the country, and it was arranged that the boy should steal across the border with another woman from a neighboring town who was also going to America. In the dead of night, a cart drew up, and he climbed in, and the woman was already hidden. And when they got to this river, and they rowed across, and Mrs. Nye thought that it was probably the border, a patrolled border. And once they were across this river, they traveled to Hamburg, where they got a boat for the United States, and they traveled in steerage, which meant that they traveled in the bottom of the boat and with poor food and poor conditions. And when the boat docked at Ellis Island, her father was very excited, and he looked for his mother and sister, and he remembers watching these men in the white coats, and they would call the names of the immigrants when their relatives arrived to pick him up, and he thought this was a wonderful job because it made so many people happy, and he thought that was what he would like to be when he grew up. And finally his name was called, and he ran to embrace his mother. But she held him at arm's length because he was covered with lice from the boat trip. And when they got home, the first thing she did was burn all his clothes that he had on. And then he remembers that his mother and sister worked in a cigar factory, or either it was a cigar factory or the garment industry. For a year and a half, he went to school, and that was the only schooling he had in his whole life. And when he was around 11, he taught himself to play the piano, and he used to play on Saturday nights at Jewish weddings for a dollar. And when he was 12, he worked at Macy's, and from then on, he lived alone in furnished rooms. This story was told to me by Mrs. June Knight.
My name is Susan Rask, and I got this story from my neighbor, Mrs. Levine. Well, she comes from Austria, and she came from a little town called Sakalovka. She came to Ellis Island in 1913 at the age of 18. She went to night school and learned the trade of a finisher in children's clothes. One of her most exciting experiences was when she first saw the faucet. She had never used one, and she thought it was a miracle to her because in Europe water is very scarce. They were not able to take a bath very often because it cost money. They had private baths where they would pay 5 cents, so when she came to America she would sit in the tub at night. At her job as a finisher, she worked 10 hours a day for 5 days a week and earned $4 a week.
My name is Jennifer Collins, and I got my story from my mother, Mrs. Mary Evans. I got my story from my mother, Mrs. Mary Evans Collins. My mother's family comes from the West, but like all Westerners, they started out in the East. My great-great-grandfather, Orville Stevens Evans, was one of the first settlers in New Mexico before it became a state. One of the jobs that he had was to drive the stage between Gallup, New Mexico, and Farmington, New Mexico, to carry the mail. This was 130 miles across the desert and the Navajo Indian Territory. After New Mexico became a state in 1912, and after the first automobiles, my great-grandfather drove the first cannonball, which was a kind of automobile, to carry the mail across what was then the Navajo Indian Reservation. Then he went to live on the reservation at one of the Indian agencies. This was in Shiprock, New Mexico. My great-grandmother was postmistress at Shiprock. The whole town of Shiprock, which was 100 miles from Gallup and 30 miles from Farmington, consisted of the trading post, the O.S. Evans garage, the post office, the Evans house made of adobe bricks, the hotel also made of adobe bricks. Also in this town was a priest's house, a little church, a school for Navajo children, and a hospital also for the Navajo people. These were the days of Billy the Kid and Jesse James. My great-grandmother used to tell the stories of when the people of Shiprock went to dances and the men would have to leave their guns at the doors, but they would not take off their 10-gallon hats for fear that they would be stung.
My name is Carrie Juergens, and I got my story from my mother. When my grandfather first came to America, he landed in New York. He came just before the First World War from Austria, Poland. And when he came, he didn't have any money, and his father, who was the only other person from his family here, was in Arkansas, so he had to look up some relatives in New York. Well, they were pretty distant relatives. And once he came to live with them, he had to get a job because he had no money. And he was very young and enthusiastic about America. And soon he got his first job. It was at the Jewish Arts Theater on 2nd Avenue. He was hired by an actor as a member of his claque. A claque is a group of people who are hired to applaud when the actor comes out on the stage. They applaud and try to stop the whole play so the actor can bow, and they throw things at him, you know, money and pennies. He loved the theater, and he would have gone, you know, the actor paid for his tickets and paid him for doing this, and he would have gone if he had enough money and paid for his own tickets just by himself. There was a lot of rivalry among the actors, and he was hired by several of the actors.
My name is Frances Campbell, and this was told to me by my father. When my father was in high school, a lot of funny things happened to him. And this one started when he and three other boys were given an assignment in chemistry. And my father and these three boys weren't present when the assignment was given, and they were supposed to be. So they didn't know what to use in the experiment. And it was due in about a week. And since there was no one to ask about the materials, they decided to experiment themselves. So they went to the lab, which is in the ground floor of the building. And they started to mix chemicals together, trying to get the formula which they were supposed to have. So after they mixed it, they left it there in the test tubes overnight. And the next morning they returned to see how the experiment had come out. And all the chemicals had compounded overnight, and they had a terrible smell. So they put the chemicals in bottles and sealed them, and opened the windows to air the room and put the bottles in their lockers. And then they forgot about the experiment until it was due. And when that time came, they didn't know what to do. They had to show the teacher something. And they figured that if they caused a great confusion in the classroom, no classes could be held, and the teacher wouldn't get around to them. So they opened the windows and put the four bottles in the four corners of the room. And the whole room started to smell, and classes couldn't be held that day.
My name is Jeffrey Collins, and I got this story from my mother. It was how she learned to fly. And her little brother, whose name is Billy, always wanted to fly when he was young. And finally, when he was 16, his parents let him go to the airport and get instructions. So my mother decided that she wanted to fly. So she got these lessons from a real big 200-pound man or something. And these cockpits are very small, so slightly tight. And you had to get a flying license. And the main thing that you had to do to get a license was to put the plane in a dive and take her a spin and take her out of it. And the way you put a plane into a dive is to bring it up too high so that it turns over and starts spinning downward. So she had to get in the cockpit with this man, and these huge, and they put on these parachutes so that you could hardly breathe. And they got in there, and she put it into a spin and everything. But the man flew her upside down, which apparently, by the airport said, is only reserved for ladies.
Well, my name is George Bridges, and I got this from Lenny Gillis. And he told me when he was down south in North Carolina, how he spent his night in jail. Well, it seems though he was riding one day in a car in which he thought was within the speed limit, and he got stopped by a police car or police patrol, and they brought him into the judge, and they said he was five over the speed limit, and so he had to pay $15 fine, and so. So he went on, and when he came back, it was getting kind of late, and he had to hurry home. So it seems as though his foot got stuck on the gas pedal, and he was going 115 miles per hour. And the state police stopped him, and they brought him into the next town. And he had to pay $100 fine. And he didn't have that much money, so he had to stay in jail. And so after a while, he said it was okay. About first 2 hours went by fast, and then the second few hours seemed to get tedious for him, and felt he was being closed in and everything. And so finally he heard the voice of his aunt and uncle and grandfather, and he was relieved, and then he died.
My name is Ingrid Rose, and I got this story from Helen Rubinette, and it is about Halloween and how the kids used to play real mean tricks on the grown-ups that wouldn't give them candy. Like they put toothpicks on the bell so it would ring and it got stuck. Or they put water all over the floor. So when they went out, they slipped. That's
it. My name is Kathy Zeitz, and I got my stories from my grandfather. He was born in Russia, and he lived in Odessa. For a living, his father had a livery stable, and ever so often they would take the horses to the Black Sea to bathe them. So one day, my grandfather took a horse out to the sea. This horse was just bought from the army, so they had to break it in. As my grandfather was riding along the pavement, and then as soon as he got on the dirt road, the horse ran like the wind and kicked him right off. So the other men that were with him ran after the horse into the Black Sea. So finally, when they got into the Black Sea, they got the horse. And another story he told me was coming across the frontier. It was hard, he said it was hard to get a passport. And he was brought over on the frontier by a guide over the Austrian border in 1906. It took one night, and during that night, ever so often they would hear shooting, and when they heard that, they'd have to lay down, and it was very muddy. But it only took one day. After he got across the Austrian border, he went to Broad, and then to Arras. After that, he crossed the journey into Belgium, where he got the ship. It was a very rough voyage, and everybody was sick except him. and he got to have all the food he wanted, and he thought that was really great. He landed in Castle Garden, and the day after he got there, he was picked up by his aunt. When they needed help, to go to America, they would go to the Hebrew Immigrants Aid Society. When he got to the city, the main difference he noticed was the freedom. And the city wasn't quite, not so different, because he used to live in a city, so it wasn't different. One of the first jobs he had in the city was stuffing teddy bears. Another job was making cones. Also, opportunities were much better in America. He went to night school, and he also went to New York Trade School. And another place where he would learn English was the Education Alliance. Some of his brothers and relatives were pharmacists, jewelers, and salesmen. He lived in the Lower East Side, which was the center of culture. At that time, a lot of different organizations were being developed. Lectures were taking place, and they had all different kinds of views. During his time, they elected the first socialist congressman. The Bowery at that time was about the same as it is now, as far as the unfortunate people who were around there. The activities which existed were dramatic groups, and the only day they had to do they could do anything they wanted was on Sunday, and every Sunday they would go swimming at City Island. Also, the people of the Lower East Side helped to elect socialists in the state assembly. He mentioned that he knew an outstanding writer of poetry as a young boy. I'm not quite sure of the name. And he also knew a man as a young boy who became a judge. I also got something from my father. When he was, as a young boy, during Halloween, they would play pranks. So one of the pranks that they played one year was they shimmied up the flagpole, and they put a chair on top of it. So the next day, the janitor had to get it down.
When my grandparents first came to America from the West Indies, and they lived in Oregon, that was 1920. And they never rode a subway or anything. The transportation they had there was just horses and that's about all. And when they found out that the subway was transportation, they decided then they wanted to go back to the West Indies. So they finally asked somebody a subway to Jamaica, and the man said, you walk up three blocks and you find the subway to Jamaica. Then the subway only cost 5 cents, and they took the subway. They wound up in Jamaica, you know, and they thought it was Jamaica West Indies. And then they kept on walking and everything. They said, "Sure has changed since we've been here." and they finally ended up in a dead end street. My name is Hazel Severin.
I got this story from my grandfather. Well, my grandfather was a little boy. He lived in Puerto Rico. And the holidays are a very big thing around the islands, you know, the Caribbean islands. The college boys, you know, and the high school boys always used to ride from one relative's house to another. And my grandfather could always remember relatives of his dropping in. And it was, and he told me when he got in high school, it was when he had the most fun. And they would come every Christmas to each relative's house and ride around from relatives to relatives and give concerts with whatever instruments they knew how to play. And then they would have to be put up for the night. You know, the relatives couldn't kick them out, even if they didn't like them. And sometimes relatives came that they really didn't want to see. So they locked up the doors and they closed all the windows and they pretended that they weren't there.
Sure.
This call handle.
Well, my grandmother came from Virginia and it was very early when she lived there. She was young.
They
had lots of superstitions. And one they had there was that if you had a big grandfather's clock and it struck 13, that meant that somebody in your family was going to die. So after she moved to New York, she saw this beautiful antique grandfather's clock and she liked it. So she bought it. And the first night she had it, it struck 13. So my grandmother got very nervous and everything. And she kept telling my grandfather to take it out. So he said no. So she kept nagging him so much that about 1 o'clock in the morning, he picked it up and put it on the sidewalk. And when I lived in Virginia, something that my mother used to always get beat for was crossing over this bridge. And the reason she got beat was because this lady that they said was a witch was crossing the bridge and she fell in the lake underneath it. And she said that whoever crossed the bridge would turn into a toad or a lizard or something. So there were people standing around and they heard this. So my mother, being young, she was very curious. So she wanted to see if she turned into a toad. And she crossed the bridge. My grandmother found out about this and, well, my mother got beat.
Well, my name is Paula Frank, and this story I got through my grandfather told it to my father, and my grandfather lived in Switzerland, and the story takes place around in the year 1896, I'm not really sure, but the schools then were very, very strict. Well, nothing compared to any school here or any school around here. The teachers were, they had sticks and they would hit you, and, you know, they'd put a dunce cap on you, and they'd hang you up on a nail or on a wall. And so, anyway, this is one of the stories that my grandfather told my father. That it's a true story. He went to school one day, and the teacher he had, well, you'll see what happened to him later. The teacher asked this question about a frog and a pear. And he said, the teacher asked the children, the frog and the pear went down to the lake. Which one of them took a shave first? And one of the children raised his hands and said, well, frogs and pears don't have beards. And the teacher said, you idiot, that's a lie. And he took a stick to him. And so all the rest were afraid to answer the question. But he said, I'll hit you all if you don't answer. So one of the children raised his hands and said, the frog didn't eat him. And then my father thought, you know, my grandfather thought there was only one more possible question. And he said, The pair did. He said, "You idiot, wrong again." And he took a stick to him. And so, he said, nobody went down to a lake to shave. So, the school found out about this question, and they found out that the teacher was really mentally retarded. Last my grandfather heard about it, he was put away.
Well, my name is Vicky Bronstein, and I got this from my mother, who got it from her mother. Well, the first person in my family to come here was my grandfather, and he sent back money so that my grandmother could come here with her child, my aunt. And they during the night they came, and they were robbed. And they took a boat to Ellis Island, and then to my grandfather's had a house in Brooklyn. And then my grandmother went to school, and they used to give her mirrors so she could see how to pronounce the words. And she used to stand in front of the mirror and say, Tuesday and Thursday. So my uncle, who was around 10, he came up to her and he said, Ma, I told you a million times, it's Thursday and Thursday. And he used to get her all confused.